and stuffed earplugs in your ears and cotton wool up your nose and something in your mouth. And you wore a very, very heavy jacket and thick gloves. And then someone tapped you on the shoulder and said, "Hello, are you there? Mm-hmm. Are you there?" "Well, yeah, you're there, but hardly, just a little bit." The natural perception, the abilities one has to see, to hear, to think clearly, all those will be blocked up, flushed up as a result of that part of the situation. So the living entity, although it's so brilliant and so wonderful, in contact with this material world, we become completely covered over, and the natural brilliance of the spirit soul is manifested very little, right, to varying degrees in different types of bodies, but nevertheless, not very much. And these types of coverings, Prabhupada is explaining here, is of two types. The gross physical covering, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. This is the physical material body that we see. And then mind, intelligence, and ego, the subtle material coverings. And this too is very, very significant, these subtle material coverings. We generally tend to take that which is physical as very substantial. And modern science today questions even the existence of something called mind. Right? Many people argue that there's only brain, that's all there is. There's only the gray matter in the head. But no mind is there, what to speak of something even more subtle called the intelligence, right? And so forth. All this, the idea of the mind and intelligence are all a epiphenomena. They're a product of the connections that take place in the brain. When those connections get complicated enough, then that person, that living entity, becomes conscious. Okay, this is what consciousness is enough complication in terms of the connections within the brain. But in fact, we understand that mind, intelligence, false ego, these things are equally substantial. They're very much real, perhaps even more so, because they last much longer. We think the physical body is substantial because it lasts a long time, like for 100 years perhaps. But this mind, intelligence, ego is even more stable as things can get in the material world, because it's moving with us from life to life to life to life. And in our next life, we carry so many of the impressions and ideas and thoughts, feelings and desires that we collected in this life into our next life. Just imagine, sometimes in this physical body, right, we see we develop some kind of a problem, right? Some kind of a sickness is there, or some kind of a deformity, or some kind of an injury, right? Someone might go through an accident or just develop some kind of a problem, and so this body comes in various shapes and forms and sizes due to the various things it has experienced during its time in this world. Just imagine if you could see the subtle body of the living entity. Right? And we can, of course, experience it. We can experience our own subtle body. We can observe the workings of the mind and intelligence. But just imagine if one could see the subtle body of another living entity. What would it be like? How grotesque it would be. Because what we've been through in this material world, right, life after life after life, perhaps we were propelled into this life as a result of dying in some horrific car accident or something in our previous life. Suppose we've come from a life that involved a lot of suffering or a lot of neglect or a lot of abuse. Perhaps someone's even experienced that in this life. Right? Suppose one sense may be very, very strong, another sense may be very weak. All that would be visible in the subtle body. Very, very, it'd be a terrible thing to see. It's Krishna's mercy that we can't perceive this so closely, so directly. And we ourselves forget most of what's there in our subtle body. It's only the very little, the very surface is visible to us. And because if we could, then we'd have a hard time relating to ourselves, what to speak of others. And it'd be so intense, that kind of existence. But Krishna is very kind. The living entity is forgetful in this material world. And that forgetfulness allows us to go on in this material world as if everything is it's fine and dandy, and there's no problem. This is the material energy's special potency, right?
Avaranatmika. She covers over the living entity and makes everything really nice and smooth. It's like when you make a cake, several layers and layers and layers of cake are there. And on the very top of all those layers, you cover everything with really nice icing. So no one knows what's inside until you've got the cake. And you could cut the cake, it might turn out to be at cardboard. You don't know, right? Of course, we believe that, okay, inside is something good as well. But the point is, all we have is we see the surface, and that surface can be deceiving. Material nature, she covers us over with something, decent. So that when we look at ourselves, we look at other living entities, we can go through life feeling, actually, things are okay. Things are not so bad. Things are decent. Now, some fortunate souls, some fortunate living entities, look at their existence in this material world and decide that there must be something more. Every living entity who's covered over like this is on a quest. This quest for happiness, for bliss, for ananda. And that happiness, that quest, is like the search of the musk deer. It's a type of deer found in special places. And it exudes this amazing aroma of musk. That aroma drives this deer completely crazy, intoxicated. He's looking everywhere for this aroma. Where is it? Where is it? Where is it? And he's prancing and jumping around through the forest looking for this fragrance which is coming. Where is this fragrance of musk coming? And he doesn't realize that the fragrance is produced from his own navel. Comes from the navel. Such a powerful fragrance. And yet he spends his whole life looking for it. This is the condition of a living entity in this material world. We go through life searching for happiness. We go through life searching for power and for so many different things. And we don't realize that all these things, more than we could possibly imagine, is present in that tiny little spark of the spirit soul. It's all there. So some people, they realize this. They decide, oh, actually we should look within for the happiness inside. And they turn their gaze inward. They ask these questions. Who am I? What am I doing here? What's the purpose of human life? And so forth. And a spiritual life begins, right? Human life begins. And a person gradually inquires into the absolute truth. As a result of this inquiry, there are some people, by the power of their philosophical speculation, by their intelligence, they are able to distinguish between the body and the soul. In fact, Prabhupada says this doesn't take very much. He said any sane man can recognize the difference between the body and the soul. It's not so difficult. You see someone living, and the next moment that person may be dead. What's changed? What's the difference? Well, everything's still there. All the organs are there. All the different parts of the body are still there. And one moment it was functioning, another moment it wasn't. What's absent? Well, the intelligent person says there must be some principle inside which is giving life, the spirit soul. And so they're able to discover the spirit soul through this. Prabhupada, for example, he said that Socrates, he was Brahman realized. As a result of his philosophy, he was able to figure out the distinction between the body and the soul. And he's going so far as to say that even Buddhists here, they too can get beyond the material conception of life and achieve nirvana. Now, at this platform, right, there's plenty of, there's happiness that exceeds the gross physical happiness of this material world. Right? These people, by utilizing their mind and their intelligence, they enjoy the pleasures of the mind. The pleasures of the mind, they far, far, far exceed the best pleasures of this material body. The pleasures of pizza and ice cream cannot compare in the least bit to the pleasures experienced by someone who's on this platform. My spiritual master calls it eating the bananas of the mind. These are items of pleasure that, in fact, we may not have so much experience of. It takes a lot of cultivation in order to taste it. And when this pleasure is experienced,
one can become caught up in this and go on for lifetime after lifetime swimming in this ocean of the mind, experiencing one thing after another. Thousands of births one can take, experiencing this, feeling these pleasures. But the question becomes, what next? What's after that? Very few people give up identification of the body and then even give up identification with the mind. Right? Some people can understand, I'm not this body. In fact, you meet a lot of intellectual people. You see that the material body is not all that important to them. They're pretty indifferent to the needs of the body. But very closely identifying with the mind. Who am I? It's all up here. It's this. This is the mind. And it's all up there, identifying closely with it. Very few people can get past even that identification by their own power. And then the question that arises is, what next? What's after that? And this is where the problem arises. Okay, this is where the difficulty arises. Because some people conclude that after that point, freedom from this material world, there's nothing. It's all void. It's all over after this. This is called nirvana. Nirvana means extinguishing. Like you have a flame, like say you have a lighter, and then the flame is there, and then you blow it out, the flame. And then you can ask, well, where did the flame go? Where did it go? A foolish question. The flame went out, it extinguished. This is how Buddhists explain the ultimate existence, the ultimate reality. Not reality. The goal they're trying to achieve is pure extinction. It's a state of complete peace. But there's no one who's peaceful there. there's no one experiencing that happiness. There is just that. It's called tataka, they call it. That state is called tataka, which means suchness, thatness, the condition of being such. It's a void. It's a void. So you cannot describe it. If you say even it's happiness, you're describing it. You're describing some quality, there's some substance there, some quality is present. But quality also cannot be there. So they describe it as such, the quality of suchness, being such. And someone who's gone there is called a tathagata. Just like we have Sharanagata, someone who's surrendered, gone to Krishna's shelter, they say tathagata, one who's gone to suchness. One who's gone to such. There's Ras Madhulapuru in the UK. He said before he became a devotee, he was a Buddhist, and for some time he wanted to enter the void, but soon he realized that the void was already full, and so he became a devotee instead. So something that is void. And this is why would you want to believe this, right? In my previous college, I used to teach world religions, so we have to teach something about Buddhism also, and inevitably Buddhism has this really aura in the West as something very sophisticated and very cultured and mystical. And so most students come into the classroom with that kind of a concept. As soon as you tell them the philosophy, the actual philosophy of Buddhism, beyond the surface, the aura of it, then immediately a couple hands would come up and say, Professor, I'm not sure how to ask this, but why would anyone want to believe in such a thing? Like, why would you want to extinguish yourself? And I say, that's a good question. You could ask a Buddhist one day. I'm not allowed to criticize any particular tradition. You just present everything as it is, right? With the hope that if things are presented as they are, then people themselves, at least those who are sincere or intelligent, will kind of find their way through. Now, fortunately, I don't have to teach Buddhism anymore, but people would always raise their hand. Okay, why would anyone want this? And the answer is, well, okay, there's some kind of relief there, relief.
we won't call it happiness, but relief. Right? Relationships, they cause so much suffering in this world. Relationships, they're causing you so much suffering. So wouldn't it be nice to have a place without any relationships? So much relief, right? If your relationships in this world are causing so much misery, just imagine a place without any relationship. Your body, your mind, everything is causing you trouble. Imagine if you could get rid of it all. Just all finished. It's all over. So much relief. So much happiness. Of course, some people realize that this is not really relief. And so another version of this is saying that, okay, things are not void, but actually things are all one. There's no differentiation, no separate qualities. This is called nirvishesha, no distinction between different things. So actually, after liberation, there is an ultimate reality. This ultimate reality is Brahman, but you are that Brahman, as well as I am that Brahman, and everything is that Brahman. And so the concept of individuality, of separateness, is actually an illusion. There's no individual. Now think about this. If you say that there's no individual, it means what? You're not actually there. You're not actually there. The difference between Buddhist philosophy and the impersonalist Mayavada philosophy is actually not that very great. This is why Shankaracharya was called a Channabodha, covered Buddhist. The distinction is not very much. Whether you say you don't exist at all, you're extinguished, or you say you lose your individuality so you can't actually tell who you are, right? You don't have any sense of self, it's pretty much the same thing. In both cases, you've committed some kind of suicide, some kind of a spiritual suicide, basically. So, not very different, these two qualities. Prabhupada Pranampara says, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshanaya. Specific mission was to deliver the Western countries from the influence of impersonalism and voyeurism, nirvishesha shunyavadi paschatya. Now, his Prabhupada is saying here very nicely, very clearly. He said, if one achieves this platform, like a real platform of spiritual advancement, there is a 99.9% of fallout back into the material world. 99.9%, he says. And the 0.1%, what is that? No possibility of staying there, right? That 0.1% is not, oh, you might stay there and be happy. No, he's saying you might actually move from there to the Vaikuntha planets. In other words, this platform of voyeurism and impersonalism is not stable. One has to either move up or move down, and 99.9% of the time, one will move down from that point. Why? Because there's no ananda, there's no bliss. The natural bliss that the living entity is looking for is not there. That happiness is absent. And so, the living entity cannot be satisfied. We cannot be happy. And we go searching for this happiness, and because we have not experienced the happiness of spiritual life, of Vaikuntha, right, then the only other happiness we know of is in the material world. And so the living entity comes back to the material world to enjoy the twisted form of happiness, of rasa, in this material world, the perverted form of it, in order to find some kind of taste, some kind of juice. Because otherwise it becomes incredibly dry. Dry. It's so dry, it just dries up the living entity completely from the inside. And this living entity is thirsty, searching for some kind of happiness, some pleasure. And this, if you can't find it anywhere, well, you have to drink something. Right? You have to drink something. It's just like someone who's dying of thirst. Right? You're looking for nectar to quench your thirst. But someone gives you poison, you'll drink it. And at least, I mean, some bad reaction there, but when you're dying of thirst, okay, something you need, something wet in your mouth. Or drinking your own blood. How it's described, the material sense gratification. Anything will work to parch the thirsty living entity. So the living entity becomes so thirsty for ananda, for bliss, in this state of impersonal liberation, that he ends up coming back down to the material world. Now, this is if that living entity does not recognize the next step, the next natural occurrence. I am not this mature body. What's next? Well, I'm a servant of Krishna. Servant of the Lord. I remember one time in Boise, there was a group of, a religious group that showed up in town, an Indian group. And it was headed by a teacher. He was an impersonalist teacher. And the many members of the congregation and so forth invited us to please come and listen. There was someone So we went. We didn't know what exactly to expect. But sure enough, the philosophy was very impersonalistic. The group itself was called Nirankara, which means no form. And very impersonalistic. And the philosophy was getting drier and drier and drier as time went on. They started off with, you're not this, but your body, you're the spirit soul. Very nice, actually, similar to what we'd say. And then gradually things went downhill from there. And it was all becoming more and more impersonal. And people were getting more and more bored as a result of the whole thing. So every 10 minutes, they'd stop and do kirtan of bhajans, Krishna and Rama and so many more. And then they'd stop and they'd talk about how all this is, you know, not really matter, and we're all God actually, and we're all one, and all this is insubstantial. And then people get bored enough, they stop and do more kirtan. And you feel like raising your hand and saying, excuse me, why don't you practice what you preach? Right? Why is this, why are you doing all this kirtan? Just go on with your philosophy. Right? The kirtan belongs to us. We actually believe in the person we're singing about. So why are you doing it? Anyway, after that happened, then a couple days later, they made a courtesy visit to the temple. They called and they said that they would like to come to the temple. This is kind of traditional. You visit the local temple. They came from India, so they wanted to do that. So this gentleman came who was giving the class. And afterwards, he came to the temple, had a somewhat difficult time, and he wasn't able to actually bow down before the deity. But afterwards, we anyway invited him to have a seat and take some prasad. And then some conversation started, and he started talking and giving some, you know, philosophical points. And I was a teenager at that time, and so I was just trying to listen, you know. And things were going okay. Again, things start off pretty much okay. But I was kind of itching for him to kind of get to the point. Okay, let's get to it. Because, you know, as teenagers, some desire for a little fight is there. And I was thinking, come on, let's get into the philosophy, right? I wanted to do some mind about the debate. So he started talking. And things were getting more and more impersonalistic. And I was trying to figure out a way to kind of refute or get to him. And finally, Krishna gave me a little break. Right? At one point, he started quoting this verse from Bhagavad Gita. Prakrite priyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha ahankara vimurhatma kartaham iti manyate. The living entity, everything in this material world, the actions of the living entity are being carried out by the three modes of material nature. Prakrite priyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha. But the living entity falsely thinks, kartaham, I am the doer. This is his ahankara, his false ego, his false sense of self. That I am the doer, karta. So, this man said, once we realize that in fact this I does not exist, then we become liberated. Right? Krishna is saying the problem is I am the doer. When we realize that in fact this I is not there, the individual is not there, this aham is gone, then we become liberated. And I said, hold on, excuse me. Krishna says the problem is what? Karta aham. I am the doer. That is wrong. I am the doer. So we should accept the opposite of that. What's the opposite of I am the doer?
I am not
the
doer.
I am not the doer. It's simple logic. I am the doer. The opposite is I am not the doer. So the I is still there. Right? If you want to say I am not the doer, then the I has to exist. Otherwise, who's saying it? And who's claiming not to be the doer? It's kind of like I asked Mahindrapur. Right? Mahindrapur, you are Spanish, right? And what would his expected response be?
I'm not Spanish,
right? I'm not Spanish, I'm Bulgarian. Suppose I asked him, Mahindrapur, you're Spanish? And he said, I don't exist. What would you think, right? Yeah, bad day. We take him to the psychiatrist and say, please, take him to the ashram leader or spiritual master and say, please sort this guy out. Something's a little wrong. Every time I ask him, what are you? He says, I'm not. I'm not, so like you said, I'm not Spanish. He just stops there. I'm not. I'm not. That's not the logical response. response. The response is the opposite of that state. So Krishna is saying, you have to get free of the conception of I am the doer, this is ahankara. Therefore, you are not the doer. What does that mean? Well, I am the servant. I'm the servant. That's the opposite of that conception. I am the doer, I am the controller. I am not the doer, I am not the controller. I am servant. Dasoshi, this is what I am. I am a servant of Krishna. And that concept of servitude is what we're trying to get to. That concept of servitude is going to give. And there were many other such arguments. I'll tell you some other time when we have more time. But he gave this example of the pot and the sky. This is a common example of my buddies. He gave an example of the drop of the water in the ocean. All nice. And there's very simple, straightforward ways of refuting these. You can kind of stump them, but not too difficult. So anyway, when we develop this concept of servitude, this is where the position of real happiness is. And we find this wonderful example, positive example of a living entity who successfully made this whole journey we've been talking about to the position of being the servant in the four kumaras. These four kumaras, Prabhupada describes, were impersonalists to begin with, right? Brahma Bhakti. They had an appreciation of the Lord's impersonal conception. But eventually, they came in contact with the Lord. In fact, they came in contact with the fragrance from the lotus feet from the tulsi leaves offered at the lotus feet of Krishna. And as a result, they realized, Prabhupada says so nicely, he says, they realized that it was much wiser to be a servant. Much more intelligent. I'll just end with that verse. It says, Dasya Aravinda Nayanasya Padaravinda Kinjal Kamishra Tulasi Makaranda Vayo Antargata Swavivarena Chakara Tesham Sankshobhamakshara Jusham Apichitta Tanbo Tasya Aravinda Nayanasya Padaravinda. When these four kumaras, Aravinda Nayanasya, when they came, Padaravinda, to the lotus feet of the lotus-eyed Lord, everything is described. Tasya Aravinda Nayanasya Padaravinda. And not just the lotus feet, right? Padara Vinda Kinjalta Mishra Tulasi Makaranda Vayu. This whole line is simply describing the smell coming from Krishna's lotus feet. Right? This is why Bhagavatam has to be the topmost literature. Right? Where else can you find such a beautiful description of simply a fragrance? Tasyara Vinda Nenasya Padara Vinda Kinjalta Mishra Tulasi Makaranda Vayu. He's saying the toes of the feet of the Lord, the tulsi leaf on those toes, with the pollen from those tulsi leaves, when it becomes mixed with air, and it entered the nostrils, antargata svavivarena, of these four kumaras, then sankshobha, everything in their body became enlightened. Which, of course, was very unusual. The reason it was shocking, because akshara dushan. They had been used to a life of complete equilibrium. These are four kumaras, like four children, who didn't grow older because they didn't want to experience any of the agitation that naturally comes as a result of age. They had never known what it means to be agitated. And for the first time in their lives, they were agitated. But not by anything material. By the fragrance. Simply this air passing over the lotus feet of the Lord was enough to send them into a spin. To send all that impersonalism. That's all it takes, imagine. It's simply the fragrance coming from the toes of the lotus feet of the Lord. Imagine if you actually saw the Lord himself. What that would do. How it get rid of all kinds of impersonals and voids. They cannot stand in the presence of the Lord. So, we are over time. I apologize for that. Thank you all very much for your attention. Maybe one question?
What is the destination of the Buddhists? It seems so that they also attain Brahmajyoti, but that's not exactly their want.
So. Yeah, and they're a little bit cheated in that they want voidism, but there's Prabhupada explains that there's no void in the material world anywhere. There's no such thing as a void. Every aspect of Krishna's creation is full of variety. Right. So they want voidism, but they don't actually get it. Prabhupada here is describing that they enter the Brahmajyoti. That is kind of close. Right? Close enough. Yes, Mark?
Yeah, let's describe the entrance of the Vaikarani River.
So in between. So I don't know whether they get that experience they're looking for or not. That experience of voidism. Somehow Krishna was satisfied with that. Hare Krishna.
Then they have to start doing that. Exactly. The only way out is to say Maya does not exist.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.